Episode number 209 for The Disciplined Investor is sponsored by GoToMeeting.
The Disciplined Investor is all about you, your money, and the markets. Sit back and get ready for this edition of the Disciplined Investor Podcast.
This episode of The Disciplined Investor is sponsored by Horowitz & Company. If you're looking for a portfolio manager, look no further. Horowitz & Company, from seed through harvest, cultivating financial success.
Earnings season kicks off in a great manner. Middle East is flaring up again. All eyes are on Bernanke next week. Silver and gold are ripping higher. And we have a great interview coming up with a movie star. How are you? Andrew Horowitz here, episode number 209 of the Disciplined Investor Podcast. And it's coming out the end of April now, and we've had quite the run up, down, and up. I guess you can qualify that as a sideways market, right? We have all sorts of interesting things to discuss, and I think that one of the things that has been on everybody's mind, a lot of questions about this coming through the emails, how is it possible that we're seeing such great earnings from companies, while at the same time all this misery is surrounding us? Now, between the European situation, the Japanese earthquake and tsunami and the radiation, and China is tightening, and in the Middle East and North Africa, and blah, 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 unemployment and municipalities and inflation worries. You know, one of the things that we're seeing clearly is that the 15 to 18% drop in the dollar over the last, 10 months has had a very powerful impact on corporate earnings for companies that are based in the United States and do a lot of business elsewhere, in particular with the emerging markets. On almost every conference call that we were listening to, or at least read some of the transcript from, there was commentary about the emerging markets. That was really interesting. This is nothing new, of course, because we've seen this over the last several quarters. There's been a continuation of the discussion of the build-out and property development in China, of course. Now we're hearing that the continuation of the buying of the high-end merchandise from many countries that have been really doing so well. Look at Singapore with the 23% GDP expansion last quarter on a year-over-year basis. And you look at all the Asian and some of the, like Germany, for example, Latin America, Brazil. And it is remarkable how the emergence, if you will, of these countries has really spilled over not only there, but into our markets as well. It's almost, in a way, it's kind of reverse of what has happened over the last 20 years or so when we were fueling the world's demand, right? We were actually buying the products, we're having them manufactured, we're buying them, and we were fueling the demand. And it's like a 180-degree turn now where we're seeing that the emerging markets are actually doing an incredible job of fueling our situation. And the dollar, of course, does not hurt the situation by any means. And the dollar has been not only broken by our government due to the excessive spending that's going on. However, you whatever side of the aisle you sit on, you know there is an incredible amount of spending. The budget is out of control and our deficit is just way out of whack. And on top of that, when you look at the amount of debt that we hold that we're about to increase from 14 blah, 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 trillion up to wherever it's going to go next, I think that we have to all realize that there is something very interesting that is brewing. You know, we are seeing the combination of many different reactions all come into one. We're seeing that the Fed's movement to inflate the economy and to inflate and to reinvigorate the U.S. has spilled over into a weaker dollar. We're seeing that the European nations have wanted to increase the value of their euro and the stability of the euro, which is weakening the dollar. We're seeing the continuation of currencies and the Asian nations, ex-Japan, showing us that their overall level of balance sheet debt and assets essentially has gone down and they are much stronger and their currencies have been rising. And when you look at the commodity-rich countries, the same thing is happening. Now, on top of that, the continuation of the concern that the dollar is one day just going to simply disappear has been continuing to help drive down the dollar. Now, it passed some real key support zones last week, And we'll see if there's any change to that, because if there's the clue that you want to look for is, do we see any kind of resurgence in the domestic economy, whether it's from jobs, economics, whether it's the earnings? Does that help to stabilize the dollar? Number one. Number two, do we see any kind of, well, world concerns that crop up again? And the question is going to be, where does the money go to? Traditionally, the yen and the dollar were the go-to places. Do we see the dollar stabilize and move higher at that point? So right now, there's a lot of bets on the other side, a lot of bets on the short side, on the carry trade against the dollar. And that is also helping fuel the commodity run and helping fuel the gold move that closed at a record high, the parabolic move on silver. We're going to talk about that in a second. And of course, it is helping out corporate America earnings. So all that has been kind of a double-edged sword, right? You know, you get to a point that all the quantitative easing, all the downplay of the dollar comes around to bite you in the butt, because now you have commodity prices rising and you have fuel that's at 383 on average around the country, in some places over 425. And now what we're seeing is that the continuation of the boom in commodities, where even the demand has increased dramatically. Just this week, China has now put out an official release that their demand for energy is going to be higher than they anticipated, even as far back as 6 months ago. They reported that they, I think it's going to be about a 2 or 3% increase over what they already expected. Now, adding that all together doesn't create any bearishness with oil, now approaching, what, 112 and change. And that's without all the excess conflict. Now that we see that, again, in Syria and in Yemen and around the world, in particularly in the Middle East, we're seeing a lot of retaliation, rebellion. Libya's not settled at all. This is going to be an interesting stage right now, where we see what will happen and how the world investors will react to these commodity prices really moving to a level that no one expected at this quick of a pace. Now, we back up. I talked about Bernanke. Bernanke is going to be doing something unusual for Bernanke. No, he's not tightening. No, he's not withdrawing any of the monetary stimulus. No, he's not going to say there's inflation. All right, let's get that off the table, okay? What he's going to do is, when he releases the Fed's minutes next week, he's actually going to have an open, at least what appears to be, an open conversation with the press and with analysts asking questions, and it's going to be live. So a lot of questions are going to be coming in, and this is the move to make the Federal Reserve operations much more transparent. Maybe not understandable, but transparent, at least what they want to show us, right? What they show us will be transparent. What they don't is not. So don't, you know, we're not going to think that they're just going to show us everything and it's all going to be just, you know, wonderful and fabulous and that's about it. But the bottom line is that when you look at the overall mood of the Fed, there is clearly a divergence in whether or not continuation of the loose monetary policy and tightening will happen. There's been some discussion about how there is an understanding that the commodity inflation is coming from the dollar. Then again, Bernanke has said very clearly that it is not, and he is adamant about it. Now, here's what I want you to think about. There was something interesting I've been kind of thinking about over the last, I don't know, week or so. Something that Bernanke said maybe about a month ago, and he said, you know, the inflation, and particularly the commodity, energy, and food inflation, is going to be transitory. Now, I heard that and I thought about it, and what does that mean? It's transitory. It looks like it's, you know, once you let it out of the bottle, right, it doesn't come back. It's transitory. How does he know this? You know, you have all this demand that we're seeing. We're seeing the dollar be depressed. We're seeing the fact that people are nervous. They're moving out of certain currencies. And you're seeing, of course, nations and their Federal Reserves and their reserve banks are actually buying some of this. And they're trying to get rid of dollars, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And there's going to be a transitory inflation situation that he believes will be, well, you know, over soon or reasonably soon. No need to actually cut back on any of the QE2 and of the stimulus that is going on through that. Now, I was thinking about that because I was wondering, you know, he can actually know about this for one reason. If he's going to take his foot off the pedal from the incredible amount of stimulus that's going on, not renew or initiate a new quantitative easing program, while he may already have discussed that they're going to do a reinvestment of the maturing debt into the debt again. In other words, they're going to buy new treasuries, because there really isn't a market out there of players that are going to be buying treasuries at this point. If treasuries are so low at this point, why would someone want to put their money in, number one, a sinking dollar, number two, treasuries that potentially will be going higher over time, at least over the next number of years in terms of rates, where their value of their money will be moving lower? So you already see that China has been scaling back their purchases significantly. You see that there a lot of countries are actually preferring, hard to believe, but the European zone. So the transitory discussion could, maybe, and I say this with a lot of reservation, it could be that he is going to signal that the economy is getting to a point where he believes that they're going to do a wait and see rather than talk about maintaining the extraordinarily loose monetary policies. And who knows, maybe they'll move from a 0 to 2.5% to simply, as whatever this means, to a 0.25% Fed funds rate. I don't know if that means any difference, but maybe at least symbolically it does. So take a look at what's going to be said next week and look how the markets react, see how the dollar reacts, and then look at commodities. Those are going to be the tipping points, as well as bonds, by the way, treasuries. Those are going to be the tipping points to take a look at what the markets believe really is the underlying story of this whole inflation discussion and what Bernanke's and the Fed's move is going to be moving forward. The political will for additional stimulus is just not there. I don't see it at all. You may, but they have so much on their plate right now. They're fighting about trying to cut everything they can, even though they won't. they don't think they have the desire to do so. So, you know, we talk about that. And I think the follow-up to that is clearly the whole discussion of what's happening with silver. You know, I wrote something last week on, I think it was Wednesday or Thursday, about is it time to short silver? And of course, you get just everybody and everywhere saying, you're nuts, you're going to get run over, etc. Very well may be. But my question is, how high does silver go and for what reason? Right now, it looks like if you look at a chart of silver, maybe the ETF SLV, it looks like it's in a parabolic blow-off cycle, which never ends very well, whether it's a stock or commodity, etc. When everybody's super bullish, just absolutely crazy, come out of the woodwork bullish on something, never going to sell it no matter what happens, is usually the time it starts getting very frothy. Now, admittedly, we're probably a little bit early when we entered this position, and we're not going to be sitting there waiting for our heads to be chopped off if it does go against us and there is a real rise higher. But when you look at the bets right now by the institutions on the short side, and you look at the incredible increase in volume of late, and on top of that, the differential between the price of silver and gold, and clearly the resistance from back in the early 80s when we had that whole silver debacle with the Hunt brothers, there's something to be said about keeping a close eye on this and probably some of the silver companies, the companies that do their business in silver. Because many of these haven't had a great move, and who knows, if silver does start to turn lower, you would expect many of these companies to turn down very, very hard. I talked to some of my colleagues about this, and I have mixed results, mixed conversations. Some say, hey, you know what, right now it's in a trend mode higher, it's almost vertical, you know, stay away till this thing just rolls down, and then it's going to be time to possibly get in for a quick hit. It may roll back up for one last spook out on the upside, and then probably drop. Again, we're going to see how this reacts to the dollar. On Friday, the dollar was actually moving a little bit higher throughout the day, and silver kind of climbed slowly but surely, Thursday that was, slowly but surely higher and higher. Again, you wonder why that is. We're hearing a lot of buying from India. We're hearing a lot of buying from central banks and all that. But at the same time, is silver the end-all be-all, as we thought oil was and we thought other things were in history as well? We don't know if the CTFC is going to come in and increase margins. We don't know if there's going to be a big seller that comes in the market and says, hey, I want to take some of the profits out. We don't know if there's going to be a spook out because of the dollar situation. So I just think it's interesting to keep your eye on that, because that's an interesting and a very volatile situation. But also, I think there is some potential opportunity maybe not right now. Again, you kind of, you know, you have to pick your points, and maybe now is not exactly the right point. And again, we'll kind of move in and out of it if it's appropriate. But I think, you know, you have to take a look at what's going on there. And then I think the final issue that I wanted to talk about in terms of what's happening right now, clearly the S&P is getting towards resistance. And we've seen it bouncing off the 50-day line a couple different times now. And the Russell 2000 is looking pretty good. NASDAQ just recovered out of nowhere, was actually in a significant trend down. But yet we saw some very impressive, or at least better than expected, numbers from Intel and F5 and a few companies out there that really did a nice job, especially after all their complaining and bitching and moaning over the last few months that there was no orders and all this. I mean, look at F5. F5 looked like, from their last conversation, they were headed down the road of not being a business anymore. It was kind of like, what? What are you talking about? It's a great company, and you're this makes no sense. Stock drops 40% or so, it goes crazy. And then all of a sudden, it stabilizes. They come out with a nice earning, they're up 15%. And it wasn't just because of the fact that there was a lot of short covering going on. There was some good earnings there. Intel did better, much better. They don't see any kind of slowdown in the PC market at all, like that was being told to us for the last 3 months by various industry analysts that said that PC sales are just in the toilet. On the other hand, you look at Acer, is at, I think, a historic low. They're not selling anything. So Intel is obviously selling to somewhere. Maybe it's Apple's that are selling so nicely. They came out with great earnings. Google, big problem. The biggest problem with Google was they were hiring. They were hiring. It hurt their earnings. We talked about this so many times that the human cost of the in a business, the cost of paying people to work is a hindrance to margins and earnings. I know it sounds kind of crazy, but it is. That's where companies have really shaved off an incredible amount of expenses and been able to really ride this thing, you know, nicely higher. So I think that when you look at this market coming up in the next few weeks, I think there's going to be a lot of movement around this resistance point from a few months back, and you're going to see a lot of fighting going on. It's all going to be determined by two things. One, the continuation of the earnings and outlook, because outlooks have been raised by a lot of companies, many companies. Think about 70% of companies that have reported so far have beaten estimates, which is good because they were knocked down before. So there may be a little bit of massaging going on of the analyst estimates. But the second thing is the dollar. You need to keep a look at the dollar, because right now nobody's looking at the problems in the Middle East as a very serious situation. We're not looking at the downgrade of the U.S. as a serious situation. Japan, nope. Even though they just came out this week with an announcement that, hey, we do see that we're going to have a decline in our exports. So this is the things that right now we need to keep our eye on. But take a look at some of the stocks that are breaking out from really good patterns, whether it's breaking out from a resistance point, whether it's breaking out on volume. Keep these on your radar. I mean, there's some great companies out there right now that are doing marvelous things on a worldwide basis that are going gangbusters. So I think that when you look at the markets right now, look at the total situation, look at the earnings in total individually, and the dollar, and let's see how that plays. Let me just mention that, of course, I mentioned this last week, that we are now sponsored, for a while at least, by GoToMeeting. Great service. You know, if you have meetings that are essential to your day and your business and you need to be schlepping all around, hey, you know what? Why not just sit back in your chair, present it on your computer, and allow your clients or a colleague to see what you're doing right on their screen? It's very simple. It's very easy. I use it. It's by Citrix. It's called GoToMeeting. Attendees can just join in with just a click on their mouse and just easily look at your screen, share a whiteboard, all sorts of great things in there. There's voice over IP and phone conferencing. All this is included. And you can get a 30-day free trial by just going to gotomeeting.com and click on the try it free button, enter the promo code podcast, and get your 30-day free trial. Cool stuff. I think you should really try that. I think it's great. I mean, it's one of those great things where, you know, once again, technology is trumping all sorts of other avenues that we used to use, and is making life easier and harder at the same time, but much more cost effective. So who's the movie star? Who are we going to have up? Well, a friend that we've had on many times before, and I get great reviews whenever he's on. His name is Das, Sanjeev Das. He is the author of a great book, but more importantly, he was recently one of the players in the movie The Inside Job, documentary about the fall of Wall Street and the financial crisis, etc. So we're going to have him back and talk with him, and let's get him hooked up here. And he is clearly One of the good friends of the show, as I mentioned at the top of the opening here, is my friend Das, and he is all the way from down under, but a brilliant individual when it comes to understanding not only markets, but some of the more, we'll call them structured notes. He has a great book out, Traders, Guns, and what's it called, Das? Traders, Guns, and Money? Guns and Money?
Traders, Guns, and Money. Yep, the knowns and unknowns in the dazzling world of derivatives.
Now, before we get to that, because I think that it's important to state before we go any further that I knew you before you were an international movie superstar.
You mean my 10 seconds of fame?
Yes, on The Inside Job, which is a story, almost a documentary about what happened, about the collapse of the financial system and all that. So that was kind of fun, huh?
It was kind of interesting. I think the film is a nice summary of lots of things, but I think the most funny part about the film is actually the academics who come over as shills on a rather large scale of having accepted money to doctor their conclusions. I think that's probably the highlight of the film, at least for me.
Now, you know, you talk about that, and that's a really good thing to, I think, jump off on. So one of the things that has been criticized through the whole dropping of the financial system, the mortgages, the structured notes, the mortgage-backed deals, and everything in between, has been the fact that the rating services did not properly rate this for 100 different reasons, but a lot of blame's been put on them for not acting appropriate, right?
Absolutely.
But then S&P comes along and downgrades Italy, Greece, and the U.S., and now we're being told that they're full of crap.
Well, I think it's actually quite funny because I saw the downgrade announcement on the downgrade, the negative watch on the United States. And I thought this is a case of the S&P getting its own back, basically, because the Greeks were very critical of their downgrade. So I said, look, we do this without fear or favor. We're going to actually downgrade our homeland. But I also think the other thing about the downgrade announcement, which was kind of puzzling, it's almost as if somebody in the administration said to S&P, this would be a good time for you to announce that, going to give us some impetus to some of the budget discussions that are going on and the debt discussions that are going on. The timing was kind of weird because nothing in that announcement really is anything that people who've been following the U.S. debt situation for the last few years would be surprised about. There's nothing there that's actually surprising. And I think the most interesting thing is also that, as S&P says in its announcement, only one in three of its negative watchers ever actually realized downgrade. And at the end of the day, this is actually almost deja vu, once again, as Yogi Berra would say. It's basically like Japan. When Japan went from AAA to AA+, there was a huge kerfuffle in financial markets for all of about, I think, 3 or 4 days. In this case, it wasn't even a day before everybody went, so what?
Yep. I don't even remember it at this point. But there was another circumstance that was a situation that was used for political gain that I recall. It was the Goldman Sachs lawsuit right in the middle of financial reform that was being said that, wow, that timing was quite impeccable that we're going to throw this out there in the whole Goldman Sachs situation ahead of a very controversial financial reform bill that was being put forth by the administration. So this is kind of a secondary point that you could say that has some ringing of that history.
You're absolutely correct. The Abacus announcement, which ultimately results in Goldman's paying the fine of $550 million, was timed, I think, to give again impetus to the Financial Reform Act, which, of course, is now mired in millions of committees and thousands of rulemaking processes.
Right, right. So when we look at the situation right now, I mean, obviously there's a lot of talk about the U.S. getting their debt house in order, and of course we know what's going on in the EU, and we know around the world that basically, of course, I mean, this goes without saying, that nobody wants anything to fail because that would be a problem for everybody else. That when something topples, it lands on somebody else and it's not pleasant. But one of the things that I find really interesting is the lack of concern right now for the European situation and the lack of respect at all that the dollar gets from the global community. And even in the face of the drastic move, I think we looked at the euro against the dollar, it's about a 18% move in the last 6 or 7 months. That's tremendous.
Well, it's actually quite interesting. If you look at the euro-dollar movement, it's almost counterintuitive because the European debt problems get deeper and deeper and the solutions get more and more difficult and the euro keeps rallying. In a perverse way, that's actually not good because one of the reasons for people like Germany, for instance, is really the paymaster to actually all the other peripheral countries with debt problems is that they want these countries to be saved for two reasons. One, of course, is that they were hoping this would keep the euro weak and give them export competitiveness. And the other is a more intractable problem, which is that the German banks, if countries like Greece, Ireland, Portugal, or Spain have problems, will take major losses in terms of their lending to these countries. But at the moment, the markets are behaving in quite a different way. But I think let's just take that point on Europe. I think the most interesting thing about Europe is this problem's not new. We are now almost 14, 15 months into this crisis, and there is absolutely no sign that we have reached any sort of sensible resolution, and we just lurch from one problem to the other. And the most remarkable thing about that is the repetition in it. For instance, the Greeks, at the very early stage of the crisis, said the Chinese had agreed to buy their bonds. Mm-hmm. The Chinese actually basically said, I'm sorry, this is news to us.
Well, hold on. They said there was a translation problem.
Absolutely. There was a translation problem. It was lost in translation.
Bill Murray wasn't there to help out. We said we're going to pay the bill for dinner, not your debt.
We're not going to buy all of the country. But we now get Spain, after a trade visit to China by Zapatero, coming out and saying they'd agreed to basically buy some stuff, whereupon China politely says, I'm sorry. The answer is still no.
Wait. Hold on a second. Back up, because I read only the part of the story. I didn't see the end of it. Are you telling me that the comment came from someone in China that said they were going to put money into the banks?
Well, there's a dispute about who said what, but it seems like China has absolutely no intention of actually putting new money in. What they were saying is now, in general terms, that they've been deeply supportive of the Europeans. That's all they're saying. Mm. They are not committing new money. Mm. And I think, so we're seeing just constant repetition. The other one repetition we're seeing is, you'll remember, the Greeks fudged their debt figures.
No.
Oh, what a surprise. What a surprise. Eh? You know, it's a bit like Captain Renault in Casablanca. I am shocked, shocked to find that gambling is going on.
Right, exactly.
But basically, we now see the Portuguese come out and say, well, you know, our budget deficit was going to be 7.3%. Well, actually, it's not really. It's 8.6. Then they go out and say, we need about 80 billion euros. Then they come out and say, well, actually, that's not quite correct. But there's another 20 billion that we might need because there are these state-related entities, which are sort of Portuguese debt, but they're off balance sheet. So, you know, nobody is coming clean on exactly what actually they need. And there is absolutely no recognition that these countries are actually insolvent. They're not going to be able to pay back this debt. All we're doing now is this wonderful shuffling of debt from commercial lenders to basically the European Union.
Mm-hmm.
And essentially that means that the Germans have to keep funding these countries in the hope that someday, somehow miraculously, they're going to grow sufficiently quickly
right.
to basically pay this back, which isn't going to happen. And now it's a political issue. And there's this lovely debate going on, in, of all places, in Finland, which is a tiny country. But because the Europeans need unanimity to actually approve the Portuguese bailout, under those circumstances, we had an election on the 17th of April in Finland, and the party which actually did best was a party called the True Finns, which is a very odd party, which went from 4% to close to 20%. Mm. And basically, their platform is very anti-European, and particularly anti-bailout. And the Finnish politicians, who are not obviously part of the True Finns, are now saying, oh, no, that's all right. You know, what we mean is we will be supportive. So the point is, if Finland pulls out, well, they're not going to get unanimous approval. But the European Union then turns around and says, well, actually, you know, the rule says unanimous, but unanimous doesn't mean unanimous, so we'll find a way around this. At the same time, you have the Portuguese basically saying, well, we've asked for aid. But then you say, well, okay, you've asked for aid, but it's conditional, and it's conditional austerity. Didn't your people actually reject austerity in Parliament? And therefore, you're not going to accept what you know you wanted to do. They're not going to accept what you wanted to do. But our conditions are even stricter. You're going to accept that. So there's just a complete, total confusion. And this thing just goes on, and it gradually strangles Europe. Because we all know the truth. They can't pay back this debt. And if you can't pay back this debt, at some point in time, somebody's going to have to take a loss. And everybody just keeps trying to move this forward and roll it forward. And I think it's going to, I don't think it's catastrophic in the sense that I think there is a bit of road and they will be able to roll it down for a bit longer. But my God, you don't want to be around when it blows up.
You know, but Das, one of the things is that, you know, we all know that there's been a lot of fudging, as you mentioned, and a lot of slight words that mean one thing and could mean another, testing of the markets. You know, Portugal said for weeks that they don't need a bailout, and obviously their intent really was much different, right? The intent was, as I say it at least, their intent was to go out and basically have the monies from the public be used for their, you know, for their bonds. And then after that was done and after they got what they wanted, they said, you know what, we do need a bailout. In other words, they wanted to solidify the marketplace.
I think that's probably right. I mean, if you did that in equity markets, I think you'd be looked at very carefully by the SEC.
Mm-hmm.
If you actually made those types of announcements and then went out and raised money and then changed your minds afterwards. But they seem to be immune from that. But you're absolutely correct. And I think, what do they say about politicians? If they deny something more than three times, it must be true. So basically, it's a case of these guys do have to basically to get a bailout. But the problem is the bailout's not going to fix anything.
Yeah, but
all he's doing is shuffling.
But at the same time, everybody's all concerned. The euro is at a pretty high point right now, right? But meanwhile, when you look at the German production, when you look at, there's definitely some rolling over of confidence, rolling over production. But if you look at the general situation and just by the stock markets, they're better this year than the U.S. markets. One of the better markets is the European markets, maybe because they lagged last year. But we don't see, I don't see any banks that we should be worried about in a way. Everybody seems all happy with all this. It's like, or I should say, not as concerned as it appears to be. Why is that?
Well, I think people obviously have invested heavily, the growth industries and rose-tinted glasses. And I think essentially what people are saying is, look, there is no real solution to any of this. There's no point worrying about it. And so what we are doing is, it's almost like a French existentialist movie where you live day to day. You live moment to moment. So basically people are saying, well, moment to moment, what can we do? The first thing is interest rates are zero. Government's still pumping in money. So basically let's go and take some risk. Why? Because more likely than not, over the next couple of days or next couple of weeks, we'll make money. And they keep doing it. But none of the fundamental longer-term issues are being dealt with because they're so difficult. And there's no political will. There is basically no social will. And there's no real simple answer. So I think what you're going to see is a market which is a very, very rich trading market where people just basically can take these short-term moves. But essentially all we're doing is storing up a lot of grief. And that grief is going to be triggered. And as we all know, that grief is going to be triggered by something which none of us anticipate.
Okay. Let me, you know, don't call me, you know, call me skeptical. But here's some, let me throw a few things at you, okay? Let me throw at you the incredibly high price of oil right now. You know, a bucking up against what? 112 and 124 or 5 on Brent. And let's also talk about the high price of gasoline, of course. And let's talk about, obviously, why that's there. By the way, it appears to me that there's nothing else going on in the Mideast that's a problem. I haven't seen any news coverage of mention of this of late. You know, it's a little bit here and there. And then we throw in a little bit of an earthquake that, by the way, we have aftershocks in the 6.1 to 6.5 range, which I always thought was an earthquake, but now they're aftershocks. And we have a nuclear situation that we find out is a level 7, which we all knew in the beginning. We knew they were trying to cover it up and keep it quiet. And we see a parts and manufacturing slowdown. We see a big export drop in Japan. Meanwhile, the market goes up 2.5% that night. And my question to you is, what really would it take? Because it doesn't appear to be anything financial with the banks being problematic. It doesn't appear that the a slowdown of an economy is a problem. It doesn't appear that, you know, exorbitantly high priced commodities seem to worry anybody. And as a matter of fact, I'll even throw at you that I'm having a hard time finding how the high price of commodities are hurting margins for companies, particularly in the U.S.
Well, I think you've got two factors, just to answer your last question first. In terms of the earnings situation in the United States, I think you've got to split them up into the banks, resource companies, and the rest.
Mm-hmm.
The banks obviously aren't doing well. Mm-hmm. I saw, as we were discussing a little earlier, a headline, Goldman's down 72%, beats expectations.
Right.
And everything was fine. But mm-hmm. the point is that their business is pretty damaged. Mm-hmm. And the damage is that their assets aren't growing. I mean, if you're a bank, you've got to grow assets to grow income. Mm-hmm. And they cover that up with trading. But trading inherently is volatile, so they'll have good quarters, they'll have bad quarters.
Right.
It's just simple as that. Mm-hmm. So basically, you've got to separate those out. Resource companies, particularly the oil companies, and generally the commodity companies have done well because of high commodity prices, unless they have other problems in their business, like obviously BP does.
Mm-hmm.
But the rest, if you look at the United States in particular, there are three dynamics playing out. Number one, low interest costs. So basically, you've got one of your costs down hugely. The employment market is weak, which means that the employees have very little pricing power. So that part of the cost is pretty weak. The other thing that is really, really working in their favor is the companies with overseas operations. The weak U.S. dollar is leading to huge translation gains on their earnings. So basically, those are the three elements which is driving earnings. The other thing which is driving the stock market, in my view, is the fact that if you have your revenues flattening off, in other words, demand flattening off,
mm-hmm.
in the short run, companies do brilliantly. And the reason is what you can do is take a lot of costs out. You don't have to invest because basically you don't need any more plant. You don't have to invest in working capital, so your cash flow goes up. And we're seeing a lot of corporate actions, things like share buybacks. You're seeing basically large dividends, and you're also seeing M&A activity. Now, that works for a period of time. That might work for 18 months or so. But unless demand comes back, you're going to have a problem. So one of the triggers might well be gradually, as the earnings momentum that people are assuming doesn't actually register in the market. That's the first thing that you're going to see. And, for instance, you'll see little effects as well. You're going to see, no matter what anybody tells you, that the banks, as a result of controls and the less intense financialization of the economy, are not going to go back to the rates of return on equity that we saw, say, 3 or 4 years and do that. That's going to fail. And then you're going to see the resources industry get squeezed on two fronts. One of them starts with, obviously, the BP oil spill, where there's going to be, obviously, certain controls. The other, of course, is the Fukushima nuclear problems, which will lead to greater controls. But I think that's the first element in terms of stock markets. And you're looking for little clues as to what might start to trigger this great unwind. And the other thing is definitely going to come from the emerging markets, as well as the sovereign debt. So let's take them in turn. Emerging markets first. Now, everybody thinks the emerging markets has miraculously sort of had this resurgence. They haven't.
Mm-hmm.
They've come about because of exactly the same thing that went on in the United States and in Europe, which is massive government spending. Now, in the case of China, it wasn't government spending. It was the banks going on the lending binge because the government told them to go and lend. And that's sucked in an enormous amount of commodities from places like Canada, Australia, and that's made those economies go well. So their stock markets are up, commodity prices are up, everything's fine. Now, the key thing is, can they continue to do this? There are very disturbing signs in China where we actually have signs of overcapacity in certain industries, which are massive. There are ghost cities. There are ghost property malls. Now, they can't keep doing this, and I don't think it's catastrophic because it's a state-controlled economy, so they'll muddle their way through, but growth will slow. And the other problem for them is actually caused by a variety of factors, but the major one is actually high commodity prices, which in part is also being caused by the weak U.S. dollar. And they're having inflation. And the problem with inflation is twofold. One, if you actually look at somebody in the United States, and you look at how they consume, food and energy is a small part of their total expenditure.
Mm-hmm.
It's like 15-20%.
Right.
In China, it's like 50%.
Mm.
So basically, that's going to squeeze their purchasing power. So the great rebalancing that our political and economic masters talk about of how China is going to consume and the U.S. is going to save is going to get slowed up.
Right.
But the other thing is they're pushing up interest rates because of high inflation, and that's going to choke off growth. And there are little problems as well. And in India, for instance, we have the communications minister and several executives of telcos basically going to jail and being denied bail because of accusations of corruption.
Good, good, good. You know what? Not because it happened in India, but because, you know what, for once somebody could do something. The only thing that's recently happened is we have a bunch of guys from a mortgage company that possibly is going in. And you know this from the inside job that nobody's been, obviously,
Yeah.
There's no problem except for the online poker companies that we got to book them.
Well, I think it's all of those cases that whenever the regulators go after people, they go after the little guys because they're easier to nail. The big guys have big lawyers and a lot of money, so they're very hard to nail, so they just don't bother.
Yeah.
But so, you know, you've got those problems in emerging markets, with no pun intended. And then the other thing, which I think is a geopolitical issue and a natural disaster angle, Japan first, the natural disaster. I mean, this is quite serious. You're talking about something which is going to cost somewhere around, anyway, pick a number between 100 billion US and 500 billion. That's the cost of the
But everybody's saying that's good. It's going to be the resurgence of Japan. This is going to be exactly what the doctor ordered in order to make Japan be more competitive and to bring out the all sorts of jobs and create or stop the deflationary environment and all that. This is a good thing.
Andrew, if government spending to resuscitate the economy was an answer, Japan would be making China look like a laggard in terms of growth. They've spent 20 years doing this. That's why their government debt to GDP ratio on a gross basis is approaching 200 and net is 130.
You know what, by the way,
who's going to pay for this?
Their market is down, I think, 68% in the last 20, I mean, total, in the last 20 years.
That's before inflation.
Yeah, well, of course, which they don't have.
but fortunately, they haven't had
it. Yeah, they haven't had it. As a matter of fact, it may be positive. It may be positive after the inflation rate with deflation. But you know what? I want to just back up for a second because there's something important here. You know, you mentioned about the emerging markets, particularly in China, and Brazil is trying to stop the inflows coming in because they're getting overwhelmed. You look at Russia, obviously, just laughing their way all the way to the bank, but inflationary considerations are happening. But back to China. So their banks are tightening by demand of the government. Interest rates on deposits are going up. They're tightening, supposedly they're tightening, every which way from Sunday, right? But meanwhile, their stock market is happy. It's back to all the happiness that it was before. And I think one of the things that really is, I think, confusing for people, and I get emails about this and notes from listeners, is what is the story? Is it just this easy money that is just pouring into the markets? Because if you look, the continuation of the dollar being just drowned is just causing everything to move higher, and that includes commodities and all that. And nobody's really upset about it right now because it's okay. It's resuscitating economies. It's resuscitating stock markets. But when it does choke off growth, there's going to be a lot of finger pointing going on that, you know, there was a enormous amount of easy, almost free money that entered the markets. And, there's going to be a problem. But I don't really – I'm starting to wonder why there's no discussion about this from anybody.
Well, I don't think it's anybody's interest to discuss it. Because if you actually look at the period pre-2008, there was a lot of easy money around, but it was from the private sector. It was from banks and all the lovely, elegant structures we played around with. When the game ended, then basically what the governments did was step into the breach and flood the system with money. And the governments, I think, aren't stupid. They realized that the only thing wrong with the Ponzi game is that you can never really allow it to end.
Right.
So they basically became the person who actually ran the Ponzi game. And to some extent, if you're a politician with a time horizon of 3 to 5 years, you know this problem is not going to be resolvable in that sort of time horizon. So you just keep going for as long as you can go. And it's like everything in life. You know that there is an end, but basically none of us want to acknowledge it. And for a politician, effectively going along and saying to the electorate, rather like Winston Churchill, that all I have to promise you is more desperation, more sweat, more tears, and lower living standards, is not going to work. Mm-hmm. It's just not going to work.
Right.
And to some extent, I think we are caught in this political mire of nobody wants to make a hard decision, until literally there is absolutely nothing on the list of choices. And that's what we're seeing in Europe, that's what we're seeing in America, and that's what we're seeing in Japan. I mean, the most amusing thing about Japan is Japan hasn't had a government for as long as I can remember. So basically, everybody's looking to the government for leadership.
Mm-hmm.
I said, this is like crazy because they haven't had leadership for a long, long time.
Well, in Japan, did you recognize, Das, that when the whole Fukushima situation happened, the earthquake and all, before there was a discussion about, the tragedy and all that, the first thing that the government said was, we're going to guarantee financial stability when the markets open.
Yeah, absolutely. They flooded the system with money.
I was like,
wait
a second. How incredibly poignant that
30,000 people die, and we're worried about the banks.
Right. And that is what's going on a continual basis. Every word out of everybody's mouth is all about markets. I mean, President Obama now says that they're going to go after the speculators in the oil market. I mean, you let them loose, buddy. Not him. You know, I mean, the governments.
Yeah.
You let them loose. What do you want? You want to go after the tigers that ate the people, but you put the people in the cage? I mean, I don't know what that means. And then, you know, you look at the you know, you're going to attack these oil prices. Meanwhile, oil goes up and up and up and up. And, you know, almost to a point of a ridiculous level when we know inventories have been, although last week the DOE numbers were a little bit disturbing in terms of, you know, the drawdown. But besides that, the inventories are still at a record high. We know people have the boats and the ships around there all filled with oil. We know that there's a lot of speculation going on. All it requires is a very simple change of the margin requirement on this stuff.
Absolutely.
That's all it means.
Absolutely.
That's all we need to do is change the margin requirement.
We have seen it before. We've seen it before when people just change the margin requirement. Basically, a lot of the positions have to be liquidated.
Right.
And at the moment, you've got essentially very generous margining requirements, and you have zero cost of funds.
Right.
It costs me nothing to basically store oil. I mean, there's something like 10 million tons of aluminium in storage.
Right. And that's the other thing. That's the other thing. You know, one of the things we were studying some of the history of silver recently, and back in the 70s, late 70s with the Hunt brothers and all that. And one of the things that really brought silver up, besides the initial inflationary environment at all, was the fact that they were hoarding and taking a corner on the silver market. But what was really, I think, fascinating was that what really brought it to a peak was that when they brought in outside investors, right? And they were kind of bringing a lot of money into it, and it really piled in, and the price of silver dramatically went up. And there was a lot of funny business going on there. But then it brought me to current day, and I said, you know, one of the things that's different today than was, let's say, 20 years ago, 15 years ago even, was that the individual, the average investor, was not able to go get, as you would say, aluminum, whatever you say, aluminum, for those of you that didn't know what he was saying, it was aluminum or gold or oil or natural gas. There was no way for you to go out unless you wanted to run into the futures market, right?
But now there's ETFs.
Now there's ETFs. Then when they talk about an ETF for aluminum, I'm thinking, oh my, that's all we need. I mean, Alcoa's happy, you know.
Absolutely.
But do we need these ETFs? And this is something that one day is going to create this incredible amount of backlog and inventory of a precious metal or a commodity that all of a sudden is going to be flooded onto the market. Is that a possible? I mean, I'm not only looking for the, you know, you and I don't look for just the bad in things, obviously. There's a lot of good out there as well. I mean, clearly corporate earnings and all that, which we could talk about, but there's some weird stuff going on with these commodities, right?
Well, I think the weird thing about commodities is I always thought commodities were the last haven of sanity in financial markets because they were real and they had real purposes. But once they become financialized, I think it's very, very interesting to see what happens. And you want to see the worst element of that, which has been in huge discussions among the World Food Organizations and the United Nations, is storage of food. Because the price of food keeps going up. So, you know, the people who have perfectly integrated logistics chains, so they make the food or they grow the grain and then they store it, are hoarding it.
Yeah.
Because the price keeps going up, which causes real human tragedies in parts of the world. And so essentially this decoupling between what I call the real economy or the real world and the financial world is basically the most devastating thing that's actually going on. And the most simple element of that is the fact that the values in the financial world are now driven by almost unreal things, which makes it very, very hard to make rational decisions. I'll give you a very simple example of that. In the 1940s, say, if you bought a stock, your average holding period was 5 years.
Mm-hmm.
Today, it's less than 7 months, but that's on average. 70% of trading in stocks is algorithmic, which is between computers. The average holding period is 11 seconds. Now, given that the only reason people actually use stocks is to raise money for real investments and basically to build real things, how can you make a decision in 11 seconds?
Yeah, well, and moreover, they're also trained in the art of deception. Seriously, am I kidding? That's what the programs are meant to do. They're meant to see where the flow is going and try to reverse it, move it, and outwit.
Yeah.
The individual that's trading. Seriously.
That's right. I know. I've seen some of those things in operation, and I know exactly what you're talking about. And I think the key is this separation that's going on. But just coming back to the real economy, I think the other thing which people need to always think about is ultimately this financial economy and the real economy meet. There's a point at which they have to meet. And the way they meet is if their businesses don't make money, if people don't buy things, then these values can't be justified. And we've seen throughout history that that's exactly what happens. That's not unusual.
Mm-hmm.
And we're seeing some interesting confluence of effects, of events here. The North African and the Middle Eastern situation is kind of interesting because obviously it's just reminding us at a very basic level of the political uncertainty of certainly the Middle East, but emerging markets more broadly.
Mm-hmm.
And I think one of the things that's underpinning the oil price is a realization that, number one, it's a non-renewable resource, but number two, that most of it happens to be in the wrong place as far as most of the Western world is concerned, in basically authoritarian and unstable regimes.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the big issue here is the turmoil in the Middle East, which I think is by no means over, I think is going to at some stage affect Saudi Arabia, which is a central bank of oil. And I was very amused when the West started to usually do its line about encouraging democracy and all that sort of stuff. Because when you get to Saudi Arabia and things go kind of pear-shaped there, what are you going to say?
Yeah.
Are you going to say, well, we're going to encourage democracy, or are we going to say, well, we actually like authoritarian rule because there's a lot of oil under there?
Right.
So that's basically going to become interesting, and I think you're going to see a firm undertone in the oil price for some time to come.
Well, and how did they solve their problem recently? There was all this potential day of rage and all this that was happening inside of Saudi Arabia. Why don't you tell us all what was actually the result of that and how they solved
the
problem?
Oh, the day of rage is, Saudi Arabia has one of the most authoritarian social structures in the world, and basically they have the religious police and the real police, and they basically make sure nothing ever happens. They basically shut the country down. They mm-hmm. shut down electronics and so forth. But the most amusing element of that is King Abdullah, who is the head of Saudi Arabia and the ruling person in the al-Saud family, came back because he's very ill from wherever he was. And he drove down and basically, literally, like Marie Antoinette, started to throw money
yeah,
at people.
Really? That's
and
what I'm
basically
saying.
they spent a lot of money. And my only rather jaundiced comment was, didn't really work for Marie Antoinette very well.
Yeah, right. Exactly.
She ended up in the guillotine.
Right, exactly. But, you know, at the end, that's what happened in a lot of these places, that they said, you know what, here's some money. Now, I got to tell you, that would make me, if I were them, I'd be happy, I guess, because I get the money and all that. But at the same time, I'd be like, well, when it runs out, do we just have to riot again? And then, we riot and oil prices go up, more profitability for us. And then you're just going to spend, you know, I mean, it just sets a very bad precedent. But do you think that is something that is going to be affecting things? Because right now, again, what we have seen in this earnings season so far, generally speaking, is first of all, in the last several months, with all the things that have happened, a lot of companies came out and said they were very concerned about their manufacturing capabilities, particularly technology yep. companies from Japan. There was some discussion and background discussion from companies that says that China was reneging on contracts, that there was all of a sudden no business in China to speak of at all. There was a discussion about how that the rising price of oil and commodities was going to be margin intensive or squeezing margins. And then on top of that, we talked about how all the political uncertainty and all that around the world has really crimped the consumer confidence numbers. And then you get earnings after a lot of these management over the last several months have been complaining that looked pretty good, at least comparatively and when compared to last quarter. So did analysts just once again undercut the potential and almost sandbag it? Or was it management trying to be too conservative and they blew it out? Or was it all just about the dollar again and how many of these companies just benefited from the incredibly shrinking dollar?
Well, I think it's like all things, a mixture of all of those. But I think what we now have and have had for the last 20 years is management of expectations. I mean, basically, earnings season is PR and spin on a level which most politicians would envy. Because basically, because the most amusing thing is you have equity analysts who are almost mindlessly slavish to listening to management. So basically, they actually create the mood, they manipulate the expectations, they get the actual projections down, and then they beat them. That's the game that they play.
Mm.
But I think overall, the tone in earnings is, in the short run, I agree with you, it's positive.
Mm-hmm.
For the reasons we talked about a little earlier, low interest rates, the fact that demand isn't there doesn't matter so much because you've got, particularly for companies with overseas exposures, you're getting nice pickups from the weaker dollar. And the commodity prices, to be very fair, if you look at U.S. companies, that doesn't affect very many people because the U.S. doesn't actually do much manufacturing anymore. So it's really not about those commodity inputs. I mean, it affects certain businesses, obviously. It affects airlines because they're getting decimated because of the high oil price. But it doesn't affect everybody. So I think I'm generally positive and constructive on earnings. I don't think there's a huge issue there. But the point is, these are all short-term things that we're talking about. They can't continue. Ultimately, there's got to be demand. There's got to be demand. And, you know, we live in what I call the I economy because, you know, if you look at Apple, you know, basically the iPad and a few products like that tend to drive their earnings.
Mm-hmm.
And that's, but the point is, that's not actually highly productive. To somebody I know refers to them as the iToy series. It's like the Toy Stories. You know, you have 1, 2, 3, 4, 5.
Mm-hmm.
But the point is, they're not really productive. I mean, we're not building new factories. We're not building huge things which create their own momentum. And the other thing about all of these products is, where is the employment that's coming out of these products?
No, these products cut employment in the United States. It creates higher productivity, many of these, because of technology, innovation, and connectivity. But it does create, for example, employment at very low rates in Taiwan, in possibly Singapore, in China, and a variety of other countries around the world through Foxconn, et cetera. And, you know, that's good for them. And that, in turn, by the way, my opinion on earnings is that, yes, it is the low dollar, but it's also the demand for the goods from outside of the U.S. and the amount of money that seemingly would be spent in their dollars. It's the same discussion, but a little bit differently, in their dollars to get it. I mean, right now I know that when the iPad came out, the iPad 2, you can get the AT&T version and put it on, I think it was on eBay or somewhere. But from India, they were buying these things at like $300-$400 over base price because they couldn't get it there.
That's right. And that's actually, in the short run, also what's happening now, because the iPad supply chain obviously involves Japan. And because of the power shortages and also the damage as a result, direct damage as a result of the earthquakes and the tsunami, that's actually crimping production on certain parts. So you're seeing a short-term blip, I think, certainly in terms of price. It's very, very strong at the moment. Whether that continues longer term, I don't really know.
Right.
But also, it's actually quite amusing to see how these productivity gains are actually screwing up not only employment, but inflation numbers. There's a very famous episode recently. William Dudley, who's the president of the New York Fed, decided to take his message to the people, which, if I was William Dudley, I'd avoid at all costs. He went to Queens to give a speech about inflation, and he was making the point that, you know, there was no inflation in the United States. And he unfortunately used the example that the iPad's price was the same, but it had more features, whereupon one member of his audience asked him, when was the last time Mr. Dudley had actually been grocery shopping in his life?
Mm-hmm.
And so I think you're right. What we are seeing is massive deflation in manufacturing products, which also is not good, because basically what we are seeing is, as I said earlier, food and energy inflation. So one inflation there is food and energy. There's two things bad about that. That squeezes emerging markets where we need growth. But the other thing it does is food and energy inflation is the worst kind of inflation. Any sort of cost-push inflation is the worst type of inflation you want. What the world needs is demand inflation. We need demand. And that, at the end of the day, is the fundamental problem, because we had a period of debt-driven demand. Now we don't have the debt, so demand's slackening off.
Yeah.
So in the short term, there are huge opportunities. Don't get me wrong. There are opportunities, but they're different. And they're much, much more sporadic. And the day of reckoning hasn't been in sort of, it's been put off, but it hasn't been resolved.
Right.
And it's going to come at some point.
Yeah, I hear you. So in closing, I just want to ask you this. I know that you have a lot of experience with, the various and sundry structured notes and all that. Recently, AIG had a desire to buy back the portfolio from Maiden Lane, where they sat it. This portfolio of bad, lousy, horrible, toxic debt that was on their books that the government said, you know what, let's take this off your hands, for one, because we don't know what the outcome's going to be. Number two, it's going to screw up your cash flow and your books. And number three, it's going to make you look so much better if we don't do this, because now you don't have to go bankrupt, et cetera. And fast forward a couple of years, all this AIG says, you know, we want that back now. So in other words, they wanted it back without the risk during the time period that they'd have to take the write-offs and all that on the books. And now they magically would get this back at a discounted rate with a cleaner looking deal, although they're not clean, but a cleaner deal. What's your take on this?
Well, I think there's two things on it. I think AIG had different types of mortgage-backed investments, but the basic thing that brought them undone was actually a form of mortgage-backed securities, which are really very safe. But the problem was, despite the fact that they were safe, in the long run, in the sense that they may never, ever lose money, the problem was, in the short run, you get market price fluctuations, and they were highly leveraged. So what that meant was you had to make margin calls. Now, that's the first thing. So basically, what they now want to do is they're saying they're flush with cash, they're liquid, so they, if they take them back, they could actually meet the margin calls. And if they don't leverage it, the margin issue is irrelevant. The second issue is a question of price. Because one of the big areas that people have made money over the last probably 2 years, 2.5 years, is in buying these sorts of structured notes, because they were sold down to 40 cents on the dollar, when in reality, the worst case was you would get back, say, 80 cents in the dollar. So you could double your money in a 5-year, 6-year period. And there have been people who have made a ton of money buying this stuff. So it's the price you buy it at. So the Maiden Lane transaction that was being talked about between AIG and the Fed, I think AIG thought that because the Fed have to start to unwind all these massive investments that they've made, they would get a bargain. And that would basically be a nice earner for them. And that's basically what they were looking at, I think. And they camouflaged that beautifully in the sense of, you know, basically helping the Fed out.
The other thing
I would say about that is it's like everything. It's the price you pay and whether you understand the structure or not. And I suspect if you look at the Fed has a huge problem. Its balance sheet's out of control. We all know that. And they're going to have to come up with ways to exit it. They started this process, as you know, through the auctions. So I think the AIG thing has to be taken in that context, is that the Fed is very keen to be seen, at least cosmetically, to be moving some of this stuff or preparing for an exit strategy. So they have to deal with the optics to some degree. And don't forget, AIG is still largely government-controlled.
No, I hear you. All right, we're going to end it there. There's lots of things that we discussed here. I want you all to pay attention that to Das, because he's a smart guy and he has some really good insight, a lot of background in this area. And, of course, get his book, Traders, Guns, and Money. It's available at all fine booksellers everywhere, as well as digitally, et cetera. And, Das, you're a great guy, and I wish you a great morning. It's evening over here. Wish you a great morning and a great day in Australia.
Thanks for having me, Andrew, and good luck in the market.
Hey, thanks so much. Appreciate it. I'll talk to you soon. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Just got to love Das. He's just, I always say that when I talk to Das, I just get very peaceful. He just has a very calming way about him, doesn't he? I think he does. Anyway, we're going to wrap it up. If you want to find out more about how we manage money, we do manage money for individuals, of course, $50,000 minimum. There's a quick video, a little tutorial, a little virtual tour on the website, The Disciplined Investor, where we have all the show notes and the information where you can get information on Das and all the different podcasts. Plus, we do a lot of writing, but there's a little box there that says, hey, take a look at this video, this tour. If you want to find out more about how we do what we do, when we do it, this whole process that we call TDI, Managed Growth Strategy, with the Quanta Fund, the Techna process, et cetera. Just go there. We'll send you some information. We'll talk about it. If you're interested, great. If you're not, all right, that's okay too. But if you're confused about what to do with the markets and you want to say, hey, you know what? I'm not sure if I want to handle this. Well, let us give it a whirl. I mean, I think that if you listen to us and you like what we've said, you know, maybe we can help you out. Anyway, we'll talk to you soon. Thanks for joining me. Make sure to tell a friend, write a review on iTunes. I'll see you next week. Thanks for joining me. Bye-bye.